From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Eyeless Woman. Not so many years ago, the sign to let outside a house in London was a commonplace, far more people renting homes than buying them. Then as now, however, there were some fashionable areas where accommodation was at a premium, and the to let sign never stood outside for very long. If it did, or if it constantly reappeared, then the house was suspect. Such a house was that in Cheyne Walk, Chelsea, described to be by Mrs. Mary Lilworth, whose family once lived nearby, she told me. No sooner was a house in our peaceful and comfortable little neighborhood vacant then it was snapped up at once, so that if you saw one remaining empty for any length of time, you knew what to conclude. There was something radically wrong with it. It was haunted. The house in Cheyne Walk was generally in this plight, and I heard my father remark that he would not live in it for all the wealth in London. The empty house had a special fascination for me as a child, and I never passed it without thinking I saw some fantastic-looking creature peeping down at me from one of the top windows. I used to dare my nurse to venture through the gates, and my young blood would freeze in my veins as I saw her, after going in as far as she dared, come hurrying back to me, her bonnet all awry and her eyes pale with fright. Well, Mr. O'Donnell, you can imagine my excitement when I actually met someone who had lived in that house. She was a dressmaker whom my mother used to employ regularly in equipping us for the forthcoming season. Her name was Miss Millward. Of course, she was not supposed to waste her precious moments chatting to me, but no doubt, feeling a spell of rust would do her good, she would not unfrequently drop her work and launch forth into the most frightening stories. Of course, I gave her every encouragement. I can see myself now, sitting in a high-backed chair, drinking in every word she said, my eyes at the same time wandering to the door, in guilty expectation of being caught by my mother. "Yes, Miss Mary," I can hear her say, laying down her scissors with a sigh of satisfaction. "I stayed in that house a few years ago. Mrs. Green, who occupied it then, engaged me as an extra sewing maid during the busiest time of the season. She was a very nice lady and treated us all liberally. I was very anxious to remain with her, and as she said, she was highly satisfied with my work. I most probably would have done if the ghost hadn't spoiled everything. It broke up the whole happy household and drove her away. Anyway, I'll start from the beginning. Owing to the number of people in the house, the servants' quarters upstairs were full to overflowing, and I had to make do with the bed in the basement. I can't say this worried me much, for I don't mind where I sleep, Miss Mary, so as long as I am in a happy house. It was very lonely, though, as I was the only person down there. To be sure, I had a few black beetles for company, and they are not at all to my liking. One night, after I had undressed and gotten to bed, I heard a peculiar noise in my room, just like someone flapping a duster hard at the floor. It gave me rather a turn, for I knew my door was locked, and I told myself it couldn't be a cat, for Mrs. Green wouldn't have an animal of any kind kept in the house. What then could it be? I tried to assure myself it couldn't be anything that would harm me, when I suddenly felt something cold and damp stroke my cheeks. I thought I'd died with fright, but I couldn't do anything. Couldn't move, only lie there and wonder what was happening. You know how even when your eyes are shut, You can tell it there's a light in the room? Well, I could see one then, through the red lining of my eyelids, a pale glow. I couldn't bear it any longer. I opened my eyes and looked, and, oh, Miss Mary, you can't conceive anything so dreadful. Bending over me was a white face, a hatchet-shaped face, with black hair neatly parted down the middle and caught up in loops over the ears. But she had no eyes, no eyes, and what was even more horrible, no sockets either. Where there should have been, there was only smooth flesh, just like her forehead. As I watched her, she went on stroking my cheeks with her fingers, long yellow fingers with the nails bitten to the quick. I was both terrified and disgusted, my stomach heaving every time she touched me. But her fingers held such a magnetic influence that I was eventually lulled into a heavy sleep. When I awoke, it was morning and the hideous thing had vanished. I didn't say a word about it to the other servants. I kept my own counsel and tried to persuade myself it had been a nasty dream. Bedtime came again, and I was once more alone in the basement. I was so nervous, Miss Mary, that I delayed undressing as long as I could until the candle burned down so low that it went out and left me in the dark. This didn't suit me, I can assure you, Miss, for I was almost as much afraid of the black beetles as I was of ghosts. And so, whipping off my clothes like lightning, I popped in between the sheets and tried to go to sleep. But hardly had I settled down when the room seemed flooded with a luminous glow, and uncautiously peering round, I saw that dreadful woman crouching in the nearest corner of the room. From the position of her head, which was slightly on one side, I judged she was straining her ears to catch the sound of my breathing, and I watched the twitching of her ugly fingers, which were stretched out towards me. She then began to creep forward. It was more than flesh and blood could stand. I sprang out of bed, and I have dim visions of the eyeless woman, now raised to her full height, very tall, bounding after me as with frantic screams I raced pell-mell out of the room, along the passage, and up the stairs. What astonished me most is that I did not break my neck, for during that mad stampede I overturned chairs and tables and cannon into half a dozen walls. When I got into the hall, I was baffled, for I didn't know that part of the house and could no more find a staircase in the dark than I could fly. This was terrible, as the woman was close at my heels, and I seemed to hear the swish of her long fingers through the air each time she made a grab at me and missed. Oh, how hard I tried to reach those stairs, tugging against the leaden weights that seemed to bind my feet to the floor. Fortunately, my shouts had not been in vain, for both guests and servants heard them, and as I fell, exhausted and fainting, in the middle of the hall, help came. I was told afterwards that one of the gentlemen swore he had seen a shapeless something rise from my body and scud away as the lights drew near, but no one knew exactly what to make of it. Shortly after this had happened, the cook, on entering the larder, almost ran into the ghost, bending down and apparently trying to dig a hole in the ground with its hands. In her fright, cook dropped the dish she was carrying, at which the figure instantly disappeared. Master Arthur saw it next. He was Mrs. Green's second son, a dear young gentleman, passionately devoted to music. He was playing the piano in the breakfast room one morning. No one was with him, and so happened that no one else was in that part of the house. But Mrs. Green, who was within earshot, noticed that the music stopped suddenly. This would not have worried her normally, but she had been told by the doctor only a week or two previously that Master Arthur's heart was in a weak condition. She became alarmed, and fearing he might have taken suddenly unwell, she hurried to the breakfast room. There the most appalling spectacle met her eyes. Lying on his back on the ground was her son, white-faced and helpless, while crouching over him, her long fingers busily engaged in stroking his forehead, was the ghost woman. Mrs. Green was held powerless until she saw the fingers begin to move towards her son's throat. No fear on earth can make a mother silent when her children are in danger. She screamed loudly, and the moment she did so, the specter vanished, but in a curious way, rising in midair, floated forward, disappearing head first through the wall. On reviving, Master Arthur told us all, for his mother's cries had brought several of us to the spot, that as he was playing, he suddenly felt he was no longer alone, and on glancing behind him, his face all but touched that of the ghost woman, and he fell from his stool in a dead faint. Nothing would induce Mrs. Green to keep the house after that. She was not going to risk Master Arthur's life, she said, for all the houses in London. She would send the children away immediately and give up the tenancy at the end of the season. This she did, though not before she had another scare. It was the day after the children had left, and she had gone to the nursery to see that nothing had been left behind, for Mrs. Green was one of those ladies who, although she kept the housekeeper, liked occasionally to see that everything was right herself. She was looking around when she saw the door of the wardrobe suddenly begin to open of its own accord. Completely paralyzed, she stood glued to the ground, full of the most horrible anticipation. Gradually, inch by inch, the door opened, until she could see the hatchet-shaped head of the eyeless woman protruding through the opening, and the next moment a pair of hands, their long fingers waving to and fro, came lunging forward in her direction. This broke the spell. With loud yells of terror, Mrs. Green rushed out of the room, and flying wildly down the corridor, frantically flung herself into the arms of her startled husband. She must have run hard, poor lady, for the armpits of her dress, which I had to mend afterwards, were saturated with perspiration, besides being torn out of the gussets. A regular panic now set in, guests and servants declaring they could not stay any longer in such a house. So the Greens, being only too anxious to leave, had the furniture removed and the place shut up. There now, Miss Mary, you know as much about the haunted house as I do, and certainly more than most people. But is there no explanation, Miss Millward, I asked, nothing that could account for the ghost? No, she replied, only what the boots told us. He had lived round these parts all his life, and had heard it rumored that a very wicked lady had once lived in the house, and that she was supposed to have murdered her husband and stepchild in order to marry again. But instead of marrying, she was smitten with smallpox or some equally terrible disease, which deprived her of sight and led her to committing suicide as the shortest way out of her troubles. Mrs. Lulworth concluded, and that, Mr. O'Donnell, is all Miss Millward could tell me, and not a very satisfactory explanation at that. But many years later, my mother happened to meet Mrs. Green and obtained from her a full account of the haunting, which, although differing slightly in one or two respects from Miss Millward's version, tallied with it very closely in the main. As regards the identity of that hideous ghost woman in real life, however, there was no information forthcoming. Every inquiry by Mr. Green drew a blank. Perhaps her poor soul has rested now, though I must confess, I often wonder. The Highbury Horror. It was during the summer of 1900, on a warm, bright afternoon, that my artist friend, Mr. Stock, who was in his 70s, told me of the horror he experienced as a young man in a house in Highbury. It was an odd setting for a ghost story, as we sat eating tea with strawberries and cream, and perhaps all the more chilling for that. Mr. Stock's memory was clear as a bell as he described to me his strange encounter 50 years ago, which I detailed in my notebook as he spoke on that lazy afternoon. Since I first wrote of Mr. Stock's experience, some embroidered variations of it have appeared in print. What follows is the artist's story exactly as he told it to me. The house in question was an old square in Highbury. It bore the ill omen number 13, and for years had in its tiny front garden a large board with "to be sold or let" in large lettering in it. I have called the place in which the house was situated a square, because that is what the authorities, who named streets in London, then styled it. In reality, it was just a narrow, long enclosure, where a score or so of melancholy trees cast their shadows on a wilderness of tall grass and rank weeds, and all the houses around it seemed to have acquired an air of chronic damp and gloom. It was not a cheerful spot. The sun rarely seemed to discover it, and at this date, the year was 1849, almost every other house in the square was empty. Number 13 had one great attraction for Mr. Stock, however. It was in a cheap locality, and the rent asked for it was small, ridiculously small. Stock took the house, furnished, employing as his housekeeper a Mrs. Brown, who had been strongly recommended by the landlord. She undertook to run the establishment for him, with the aid of a charwoman, to do the very rough housework. Stock did not work in the house. He shared a studio not far away with a fellow artist. The first night of his stay in the house, he arrived about 10 o'clock, and being tired after a long day's work, he asked Mrs. Brown to show him to his room at once. She went upstairs with him. It was rather a winding staircase, and his room was on the second floor. On the way up to it, he had to pass a window a little above the first landing, just where the stairs took a sharp curve. Curious to see what the window looked out on to, he tried to peer out of it, but the inky darkness outside merely revealed the reflection of his own face, and oddly enough, the reflection of two other faces. One was that of Mrs. Brown, and the second face, close beside hers, seemed to be that of a very repulsive-looking man. At least, that was Stock's first impression. But he concluded afterwards there must have been somehow some curious flaw in the glass, and that both reflections were those of Mrs. Brown, who was certainly far from good-looking, though not exactly ugly. He found his room quite comfortable, and tired as he was, he slept right through the night without waking. The following day found him again at work in his studio, but he left early, and after a meal at the restaurant, which he usually patronized in Soho, he went home, getting there in time, so he told himself to do a little reading before turning into bed. Retiring to his room, he settled himself in front of the fire with a bundle of magazines. But he had not calculated on the effects of the fire, which made him so drowsy that before very long he was fast asleep. He awoke with a start to find that the fire had burned very low, and that the room, in consequence, was in almost total darkness. Indeed, there seemed scarcely enough glow in the embers to light a candle, in which case, having no matches, he would be unable to see to undress and get into bed. But a few skillful touches with a poker soon produced a cheerful flame. As he straightened up from the fire, intending to get a spill or paper lighter from the mantel shelf to light his candle, his glance fell on his own face reflected in the mirror in front of him, and he saw, too, another reflection, which caused him to stop and stare in astonishment. Standing at the far end of the room, facing the door, was an elderly woman he had never seen before. That she had not been in the room a few minutes previously, he could swear, for he had looked all around the room, and in spite of the dimness of the light, had seen well enough that he was alone and that the door was closed. It was closed now, yet how could she have opened and closed it without his hearing? It was strange, too, that she did not trouble either to speak to him or even to glance in his direction. She simply stood still, her face turned towards the door as if listening. That she was someone belonging to the house seemed evident, too, since she was wearing a kind of negligee gown of white cambric with deep frills down the front and at the wrists. Who could she be, he wondered. Some friend of Mrs. Brown's who had mistaken his room for her own? At that moment the fire shot up into a brilliant flame, throwing a bright light on the woman's face and making it startlingly clear. Never in his life had Stock seen such a face before, and never, he told me, would he wish to see one like it again. The woman, she might have been 60 or more, had grizzled hair, and her general appearance suggested feebleness. Her face, too, was lined, but it was her expression that riveted Stock's attention and appalled him. It was an expression of hopeless, utter despair, and ghastly, speechless horror. She was concentrated in the effort of listening, and so intense was this effort that it appeared to absorb every nerve and fiber in her body. She was listening to something outside the room, away on the landing or stairs, to something which from her widening eyes and the quivering muscles of her lower jaw seemed to be drawing nearer and nearer. Then, as Thak continued to watch, the door began to open slowly and the woman shrank back, nearer and nearer to the wall, the horror in her face growing more and more fixed. Suddenly, the fire flame died down, the room was plunged again into near darkness. Moments later, another spurt of flame revealed to Thak, still standing there, unable to believe his eyes, that the woman was gone. The room was once again empty and the door closed. Yet there had been no sound, not even the lightest footfall. The house was wrapped in unbroken silence. The following morning, Thak tackled Mrs. Brown and asked the identity of the elder lady who had visited his woman. The housekeeper eyed him curiously. "You've been dreaming, sir," she said. "There wasn't anyone in the house but you and me." "Did you leave the hall door open by mistake?" Mrs. Brown was indignant. "Why, I'd never think of doing such a thing. The idea of it was shut and locked as soon as it grew dark." But Thak persisted. He said, "An elderly woman in a loose kind of dress of white cambric was in my room at about 10 o'clock last night." Mrs. Brown replied starchily, "Then all I can say is you must have let her in yourself or been dreaming." "It was a dream, I expect. Gentlemen who study art or who work in studios often have queer dreams. I've heard them mumbling to themselves at night." "It was no dream," Thak insisted, but he then dropped the matter. About a fortnight afterwards, he returned home late one night from the theater. There was no light in the hall or on the stairs except from the candle he carried. After putting the candle ready for him on a chair, Mrs. Brown had turned out the gas. Thak went upstairs. When he came to the curb and the window, he had a sudden impulse to look at the window again, and gazing into it, he saw himself reflected at full length. Then, with a cold shock, saw also the head and shoulders of a man, apparently, coming up the stairs behind him. Turning sharply round, Thak then saw, creeping slowly with stealthy, noiseless footsteps up the stairs, a hunchbacked man in shirt sleeves. His head was slightly bent, and at first Thak could only see a man of coarse, shaggy red hair, not quite long enough to conceal a pair of large, crinkly, misshapen ears. Then, as the hunchback came on round the curve of the stairs into full view, his face became clearly visible. Some strange light, other than the flickering flame, seemed focused on it. It was the same dreadfully repulsive face Thak had seen in the window on the night of his arrival, a low, retreating forehead, a nose that looked as if it had been broken in a fight, loose sensual lips, brutal wolfish jaws, light eyes illuminated with an expression of deadly sinister determination. It was the face of some terrible beast of prey, rather than that of a human being. In one hairy hand, a hunchback held an ordinary table knife, the blade of which, worn to a point like a dagger, had evidently been recently sharpened. Stair by stair, with a snake-like crawling movement, the hunchback drew nearer to Thak, who, spellbound, shrank back close to the staircase wall. The man, however, did not appear to notice him, but passing by, crept on silently up the stairs towards Stock's bedroom. Compelled by some power inside him which he could not resist, Thak mechanically followed the creeping figure. When the hunchback arrived at the bedroom door, he paused for a few moments and looked at the knife in his hand with a grin of hideous exultation. Then, gripping the handle of the door, his coarse bony fingers, he slowly turned it. Inside, the room was full of moonlight, which poured in a broad stream through the open window, and right in its path stood the same woman Thak had seen before, the elderly woman in the loose gown of white cambric. The cause of that look of awful fear and her protruding eyes were now only too apparent, the hunchback's face alone with evil joy as he beheld her terror. Just as the hunchback entered the room and advanced with devilish slowness on his shrieking victim, a gust of wind blew the door to with a loud bang. Stock, released from his frozen stance of horror, rushed forward and threw the door open, but instead of seeing something terrible, as he had fully expected, he found the room just as usual, with no sign anywhere either of the woman or of the hunchback. Not daring to remain in the room, Stock spent the night downstairs in the drawing room with the gaslight fully turned on. A few days later, he vacated the house, choosing, despite the desperate state of his finances, to sacrifice a year's rent rather than remain in it. Now, Stock was a really quite matter-of-fact young man who had never before entering the house seen a ghost or believed such a thing existed. After securing other rooms, he discreetly asked around the neighborhood, seeking to probe the house's dark secret. Mrs. Brown would not or could not give him any information. She persisted that he had been dreaming and that there was nothing wrong with the house. She said she had never seen or heard anything, and she had lived in it for several years as caretaker. All that Stock could discover, after inquiries among neighbors and shopkeepers in the vicinity, was that no one of late years, excepting Mrs. Brown, had ever stayed long in the house, but that years ago, before the present landlord had bought it, the house had been occupied by an old woman and her son, very ill-favored hunchback, who were supposed to have gone away somewhat hastily. At any rate, no one saw them go, but a year or so afterwards the son returned alone, saying that his mother had died abroad. The hunchback remained in the house for some months and then disappeared. No one knew where he went, and no one cared. It was after that the house was so often to let and was never occupied for any length of time, till Mrs. Brown came there as caretaker. For some odd reason, the strange happenings in the old house did not seem to affect Mrs. Brown. She stayed on alone till the end of Stock's year of tenancy. The house was then sold again, but with the same result. No one would live in it. Its dreary walls kept their dark secret to the end, when the house was finally demolished.